once I see that the device works properly, they'll release me.
I very much doubt it. You see, before you reactivated it, I reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
You realize what will happen?
Oh, yes. Do you? Well, I've reversed the polarity of the neutron flow, so the TARDIS should be free of the force field now.
So he's reversed the polarity! Keep back!
Hello and welcome to Reversing Polarity, a very queer Doctor Who podcast where we go back in time to revisit the sites of our past traumas and wonder whether Doctor Who has always been gay. Hint, it has. My name is Aim. My pronouns are they, them.
My name is Rosie. My pronouns are also they, them.
Do it.
Sorry, do you want me to introduce myself?
Yes.
It's been so long since I've done one of these episodes, so I've forgotten how you do it over here. In this more professional setting. I'm Joel Corner. My pronouns are he, him. I'm a guest on this episode.
Another person!
Wow!
What is this? A guest? Oh my god.
A repeat guest.
Episode after our last guest, I think.
Yes. You may remember Joel from episode 4, Audacious Wig Heist, one of our consistently top listened to episodes. The people that love the wig heisting.
Well, it's, you know, we still haven't managed to actually get round to heisting that wig. It's just a reminder that we need to do it.
Let's do it over Christmas.
Mm. Oh, good plan. Yeah.
The great Christmas wig heist.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. But after the incredible fun we had dissecting the TV movie, we brought Joel back for some Seventh Doctor content. What are we talking about today?
Today we are discussing the absolute mindfuck Seventh Doctor serial, Ghostlight, the second serial of season 26, the final series of Classic Who before the dread hiatus began, the wilderness years barreled into us. I hadn't seen this one before. It's weird.
The last story that was recorded in the Classic series as well.
Yeah. So weird.
I had seen this one before and I loved it because it appeals to a lot of the things I'm interested in as a person.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
As a human being.
That doesn't surprise me in the least.
It was but not the first story, classic Doctor Who stories that I saw.
Jesus Christ, Joel!
The first one I saw was Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
How old were you?
How old was I in 2001?
100.
Was it 2002?
13,
so 15, 14? 16, yeah.
Okay, that's good. Because I'm obviously every time I hear someone talk about starting Doctor Who, I think of when I started watching Doctor Who. And if I had watched this when I was 4, I think my brain would have exploded.
Instead, you watched Terror of the Fucking Autons.
Yes, I know. And it had a deep impact on me, obviously.
But yeah, so it's a Seventh Doctor story with our Ace. Beloved Ace.
Ace!
Ace being wonderful throughout. I imagine we are going to spiral out into several thousand tangents, so shall we just jump straight on?
That's probably a solid idea. So, Ghostlight, let me get back to the right tab and then scroll up. The Doctor brings Ace to Gabriel Chase. It rhymes!
Do it in the style of like an awkward 90s infomercial
the
rap.
The Doctor brings Ace to Gabriel Chase, gunpowder, treason and plot. An old house that she once burnt down in her hometown of Perivale. I've never quite been clear where Perivale is. I thought
it's
it was like
London.
A fake... Yeah, I thought it was a fake London suburb rather than a town.
But if you imagine like the sprawl of London, most places that are Zone 4, Zone 5 were towns in the Victorian era and became part of Greater London as the city ate them all up.
Yeah. All you people know stuff about London. I'm from the southwest. I don't need to know about any of that shit.
Every time I take the Oxford Tube to London, we go through Perivale and it always brightens my day.
Really? I've never cropped that.
Honest to God, I didn't think it was real. So, you know, that's my bad. however, trying to get Ace to accept her guilt is not the real reason the Doctor came here. A mysterious and highly mentally unstable being lies below them. It's us, probably. I think it's secretly us. We were there the whole time.
No, it got it wrong. It says mysterious. We're hilarious.
That is... I mean, we can be mysterious and hilarious.
Mysteriously hilarious.
The mystery can be part of the humour.
It's a mystery how hilarious we are. This is... The premise of this, I had known the premise of this is that they go to a haunted house, basically. I didn't know anything else about this serial, and as a result, I feel like I've been punched in the face.
I mean, I think what I knew is Joel telling me that I would like it.
That, yeah, Joel knows you very well.
Very well, yeah. Knows me very well, knows what weird shit I'm into when it comes to media, mainly because I sit in the living room and watch it all the day.
Gothic, it's got Ace, it's got Ace dressed in a tuxedo.
Fuck!
Yes!
Fucking hell! Oh my god!
Oh my god.
Not to be a lesbian on Maine, but oh my god.
Aim, we have an entire podcast which is just us being lesbians on Maine. We have a segment about us being lesbians on Maine.
Okay, in which case, to intentionally be a lesbian on Maine. Fuck.
Okay. Well, I feel like we should clarify to begin with here, Ghostlight is an unusual Doctor Who story in that it only has 3 25-minute episodes. Previous three minute imagine if it was 3 minutes long. I think I would genuinely explain. Previous 3-episode serial, I can only think of one, which is Planet of Giants. I'm not sure if there are any others. Joel, do you have any?
Off the top of my head, I think there are. Isn't Survival 3 episodes? I can't remember.
Oh god, I don't know.
I think.
Let's
look at the production schedule.
Survival's 3.
Oh, is it? Yeah, Planet of the Giants, you were right.
Planet of Giants got cut down from 4 to 3.
Okay.
Silver Nemesis is 3.
Happiness Patrol is 3. I guess the Seventh Doctor just had a lot of 3-episode stories, but I just haven't watched them, I guess.
Dragonfly,
Delta.
Oh,
you got so much joy ahead of you. I adore Seventh Run. The Two Doctors.
The Two Doctors, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but that's 3:45, so I think of it as a 6-parter.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, and then Delta, Dragonfire, pretty much, most of Seventh Run.
Yeah.
Damn. That's a shame, because, you know, things need to breathe in Doctor Who, and this one doesn't feel like it breathes in a good way, but some of them...
It's almost hyperventilating at points.
Yeah. God.
The novelization clears up a lot of the ambiguity in some parts of the...
I've heard that. I did not read the novelization, surprising nobody at this point in the podcast's run.
Have you read it, Joel?
Long, long time ago, yeah.
Okay.
In a way, I feel like clearing up the ambiguity would kind of ruin it.
Yeah, because, like, I think I often get the feeling that with Ghostlight, the ambiguity is kind of the point. Like, it's supposed to be weird and almost incomprehensible.
Yeah. And not knowing what goes... Well, we can discuss this later, but not knowing what's going on with the plot reflects Ace's not knowing a lot of how it ties into her as a character and her as a person.
I mean, I've watched this serial several times, and there are some times where... here's the thing, is that, like, first time I watched it, I was like, I have no idea what's going on. Second time I watched it, I was like, you know what, I think I'm starting to get it. And then the third time, I was like, actually, no, I don't. Then I was like, actually, yeah, I'm starting to see it. And I was like, oh, no, I don't. Maybe I've completely misunderstood what's going on here. It's very much like that. Every time I watch it, I come away with a different interpretation of it that doesn't make sense.
God.
Shall we get into the recap and see what sense we can make of it with Planet of Giants?
Let's shine a light on Ghostlight. Whoa.
Hey. So it starts with the Seventh Doctor bringing the TARDIS and Ace to a room which seems to be a cross between a nursery and an old laboratory. Ace expresses her concern that this might be a haunted house, saying that after one she'd been in before, she would never go into another. Did we ever see Ace go into a haunted house?
No, I think it's something that she just... I think that is her referencing this
Gabriel
exact
Chase.
House.
It's like going back to say, yeah, she's going back to the same house.
Oh, fucking hell, of course.
Because Seven is just fucking with her the whole time. And you're like, oh, Seven.
Beloved
bastard. I
love
this opening scene because it's kind of that part of the Seven-Ace dynamic that I really like, which is Seven kind of like pushing Ace out to figure stuff out while he just kind of stands in the background going, yeah, it's very good, Ace.
Yes, and then riding a rocking horse for a bit.
Yeah. It's one of those dynamics I wish that the show would bring back. I mean, I know Sylvester McCoy has said that he enjoyed it because, you know, Sophie got to do all the techno babble while he got to stand in the back going, yeah, it's very well done, Ace.
See, that would be we're recording this after the first episode of Doctor Who Flux has aired. I hope they give Yaz some of this over Flux because she needs more to do.
Yeah, it does feel like they're starting to have the slightly combative 7 and 8 style relationship with 13 and Yaz.
They're starting to call each other out. Yes.
Yeah, it's good. God, man, I'm excited. We're recording this on Sunday the 7th of November 2021.
So we've got the War of Sontarans to look forward to this
yes!
evening.
Crimean War with Sontarans.
How happy are you about this, Rosie?
I'm so fucking happy. Yes. Pseudo-historical. Sontarans.
I assume you're happy with the fact that in episode one of Doctor Who Flux, we got to see that in the TARDIS, Yaz and the Doctor have...
There was only one bed provided by the TARDIS.
The
yes.
way I fucking screamed.
Yeah, me too. I was making
the Doctor
Sammy,
and Yaz lying in their bed with handcuffs.
She doesn't even like Doctor Who. I made her watch the new episode with me. She was just there like, I don't get it, Rosie. I don't get it. I was screaming. The Sontaran showed up. I went, yes!
The fucking Cloister Bell!
The fucking Cloister Bell. I genuinely went, oh my god, it's the Cloister Bell. As if Sam would know that what that was.
Yeah, I was watching it with a couple of people who didn't know much Who, and I was like, the Cloister Bell! And they're like, what the fuck are you on about, you weirdo?
I've managed to get Sam to watch, I think, 3 episodes of Doctor Who at this point in our lives, not including that one. And I'm going to get her to watch more, but she will only watch David Tennant. So
he has some good stories.
I watched it with a friend of mine. And we've been watching Doctor Who for like 15 years at this point. I got them into Doctor Who many years ago by sending them the box set of Legopolis, Castrovalva, and Keeper of Traken. So that was their introduction to Doctor Who. So like we were just there watching it, and their housemate was who doesn't really care about Doctor Who was there, and like when stuff like the Cloister Bell happened, and we just looked at each other with wide eyes, going, oh, the Cloister Bell. And then the housemate was just like,
What I'm getting from this conversation is that we three are all extremely annoying.
And we all watched it somehow with 3 separate groups of people who had a level of not getting it.
All right, let's keep going with the episode. We have to be done before the Doctor Who episode airs, guys.
They decide to explore the Victorian house, which reminds Ace of a museum. A clock reads after midnight.
Or after midday,
we don't know. On the floor lies a metal snuffbox with the initials RFC embossed on it. The Doctor scans it and finds that it's radioactive.
I like when Ace says, is it safe or something? And the Doctor goes, radiation isn't safe for Ace.
There's no safe level.
Which is hilarious because we, as viewers of Doctor Who on this podcast, have many times come across the Doctor simply going, ah, radiation doesn't do anything to me, which is such a lie.
The Doctor has been killed by radiation at least once.
I'm mostly thinking about the mutants.
Yeah.
My beloved. No criticism. I'm just pointing it out.
A man shows up and soon mentions atrocities that are rumoured about this house.
Whoa.
He says he came here to find the explorer, Redvers Fenn Cooper, a name and a half, and
yep,
the box is the first
absolutely.
Evidence he was here. Before Ace can stop him, he pockets the radioactive box. He means to save Mr. Fenn Cooper from the clutches of that braggart Josiah Samuel Smith.
I want to say I'm loving the use of the word braggart, one of my favourite words.
Great names in this
Very
series,
much
let's
so.
Just point that out.
The Doctor and Ace follow the man as he explores another room of the old house. Suddenly the man picks up and aims an elephant rifle at them. As the Doctor dodges out of the way, the curtain behind him slips open and the man sees his own reflection in the window.
Whoa. And he's like, oh my god, Fenn Cooper, what happened to you? You look like a ghost. It's like a dog seeing itself in the window.
Who was that hunter? How did he get
not,
in here?
He has not passed the mirror test for engaging consciousness.
No. A woman in black...
That's what a radioactive snuff box will do to you.
Yeah, no, it's gonna make his dick fall off and he's forgotten how to process his own image.
Don't do snuff, kids. That's the lesson
yeah,
that ghosts
exactly.
like. No snuff films.
A woman in black, 2 others in 1800s maize garb, and a hunched butler enter.
I tried so hard to rephrase that sentence, but 1800s maid's garb turned out to be the best possible way to phrase the sentence, unfortunately.
Victorian maid's garb?
I don't know. I think it just... I was trying to avoid the word garb, because garb is coming up so... It's like... It's TARDIS Wiki's favourite synonym for clothes. It loves it so
it's
much.
It's garbage.
2 others in a Victorian maid's uniform.
Yeah, anyway, it doesn't really matter. I found it funny when I was trying to edit
garb.
the
Yeah, thank you.
The entries.
The woman in black says, Fenn Cooper, we were worried about you, and then roughly twists his arm up behind his back and marches him out.
Thank you, Joel, for changing it to attire.
The butler, Nimrod, explains that the man is unbalanced and is under their care at the house. He then says his master, Mr. Smith, asks if they would join his other guests in the drawing room.
Nimrod is great. Nimrod is my favourite guy.
He's great. He's Nimrod, a great voice.
Is Homo neanderthalensis. He is a Neanderthal who is just in a butler's outfit and is very well spoken. You're like, I love that this guy is here. I can't wait for it not to be explained for like another episode and a half.
It's one of those great sort of Doctor Who-isms of like something mundane with a weird twist to it. So like,
very,
you know,
incongruous.
Just a butler.
Yeah, it feels almost fairy tale like, all of this random shit. It reminded me of I know this is once again an EU cut, but it did remind me of the Chimes of Midnight, just the whole vibe of the story.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you pointed out when we were watching it this morning, Joel, is how many Alice in Wonderland allusions there are.
Yeah,
very much fits the vibe.
I mean, like, one of the things I found quite interesting on this rewatch is that often, like, when the Doctor and the companion land somewhere, there's at least, you know, half an episode of them explaining, oh, we're here for this reason, and people saying, what are you doing in here, and how did you get in here? There's virtually none of that in this episode. People just kind of accept
that the Doctor is there. Like, at some point he starts leading guests around the house, and everyone's like, oh, Doctor, okay, we'll follow you. Why not? Really adds to the surreal nature of everything that's going on.
I mean, there is a thing that, like, we watched it with the production notes, and it points out that there are supposed to be cameras in the eyes of the toys in the toy room when they first arrive.
I mean, they sort of show that.
Yeah.
With the lights in the eyes going on and off. Which I found extremely, extremely creepy, and they didn't explain.
And it's never brought up again.
It's just all weird.
Yes. And it all vibes weirdly. There they meet Smith's ward, Gwendolyn, conversing with the Reverend Ernest Matthews. Matthews assumes the Doctor is actually Josiah Smith, and begins criticising his ethics and far-reaching support of the newly popular theory of evolution. After the girls leave together, the actual Josiah Smith comes in wearing dark glasses and dims the lights. He then welcomes Matthews and the Doctor to the old house, which is called Gabriel Chase.
Yeah, I love the name Gabriel Chase, because, like, obviously when light turns up, he's sort of angelic. So you end up with, like, an angelic name for this place where this angel has just been trapped for thousands of years going insane over how much he hates everything that's going on.
And can you blame him?
No, I can't.
Soon Fen Cooper can be heard screaming, and everyone converges at his door. The Doctor makes his way in to see a bright light pouring from the snuffbox, but Nimrod forces him back out of the room again. The guests are told to leave him to the house staff.
There's a really good kind of atmosphere about this that kind of leads into, well, reflects what a lot of old English kind of aristocratic families can be like, in that there's this drive to kind of hide everything that's slightly unusual behind this veneer of everything's normal, everything's
fine.
It's
essentially Rochester keeping his wife in the attic.
Yeah.
Control is the birth of Rochester, and she will be setting fire to the house.
I do quite like the Reverend Ernest Matthews, incidentally. He's such a hilariously pathetic figure.
He's such a specific character. And obviously, this is set in, what, 1883? So it's actually like 25 years after On the Origin of Species came out. And this guy still can't cope with it.
Also accurate to the time.
Oh, no, definitely, yeah. But I love the way that this serial approaches evolution just as a horrendous, horrific concept, but also it's just how everything works, my dude. I'm very sorry. It's good.
Yes, let me guess. My theories appall you, my heresies outrage you, I never answer letters, and you don't like my tie.
Yes. You are a worse scoundrel than Darwin.
The Reverend Ernest Matthews finally gets his long-awaited meeting with Josiah Smith and immediately carries on with his criticisms, as we have just heard. Mm-hmm. Smith has the matron chloroform him. Brilliant response. Wish I could do that to everyone I ever disagree with.
Don't chloroform people.
That was
dangerous.
That was humour for dramatic effect.
I know. I'm just saying,
give people
for the
a
benefit
look
of the listeners. Chloroforming people is a bad idea.
Don't do snuff. Don't chloroform people. There's two important lessons in this serial.
That can be the title of the episode. Don't do snuff and don't chloroform people.
Back in the drawing room, Ace and the Doctor observe that Nimrod is a Neanderthal. Then Ace becomes agitated at hearing that they are in a house called Gabriel Chase. The Doctor catches up with her and they relay that this was the haunted house she entered, or will enter, in her hometown of Perivale near London. She had gone in on a dare in 1983 at the age of 13 and felt an evil presence. As Ace tells the story, she becomes agitated and again runs off. My poor child.
They clarify that she had already told the Doctor this story, so he's definitely doing this with her, and it's like, seven!
Yep.
It's such
you
a good scene,
rat
though.
Bastard, I love you, but God.
I think this is where the story starts to pull its emotional weight as well, because there's a lot of confusing bits, and then because we're already invested in Ace as a character in this stage of her run, it makes it easier to overlook it because you care that she's distressed.
Yeah, we should note that at this point she's wearing an extremely sexy outfit also. I just want to clarify. Oh, yeah.
Beautiful neckline on that top.
Yes. Gwendolyn, the ward of Mrs. Smith, takes her off to go and get changed because everyone keeps complaining about Ace's outfit, which, to me, for the record, is also incredible. It's like the
That's what I was mentioning, yes. I couldn't remember if they'd had that bit already.
Swoopy t-shirt, black leggings, and everyone's... and she's very annoyed that everyone keeps saying she's inappropriately dressed, but they take her off and then she's like, I think we should wear tuxedos.
And they do.
And they do. It was Ace's idea.
She was correct in her in her assertions. But this is one of my favourite Dr. Ace scenes where they have this confrontation where the Doctor is so sure that he's like doing this great thing to sort of help her deal with this trauma, and she's like, there's that great, you know, we all have a universe of our own terrors to face, and she just has the great response, I face mine on my own terms. It's such a good kind of distillation of their relationship that, you know, the Doctor's there like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm teaching you, I'm being this very sneaky, manipulative little sneak, and Ace is just like, no, you're being an ass. Can't stand burnt toast. I loathe bus stations. Terrible places full of lost
luggage.
And lost souls.
Josiah Smith receives a telephone call that shocks him to the core. He then offers the Doctor money to help him, but he refuses. In the meantime, Ace finds her way to a small elevator which takes her deep below the house to a large stone chamber with alien technology apparent in its simple lit panels. A threatening voice speaks to her, then two alien bipeds close in on her.
Just going back slightly, the line about where Ace says when she lived in Perivale and her best friend got firebombed by white nationalists. That line was added by our old friend of the show, Ben Aronovich.
Yes. It's extremely, extremely sad.
But Doctor Who's never been political.
No. Never.
And it's I love these kind of depths to Ace's character that just little things like that add.
Well, it's the realism of it.
Yeah, and she has this great sense of justice about her. I think that's one of my favourite through lines about Ace, is that she has this really strong sense of fair play and is not afraid to speak out when she thinks someone's being unfair or someone's being, you know, is being abusive in any capacity. And she gives as good as she gets. And it's one of the great strengths of her character that she has this really strong... moral compass. That
I am close to tears.
Yeah,
thinking about this, she is the best.
But yeah, that's our cliffhanger for episode
I like
one.
It as a cliffhanger. I like it how it again actualizes a lot of this otherwise quite confusing terror and makes it feel like a Doctor Who story.
My brain completely switched off for like the past 2 minutes, so I didn't even hear that you'd finished the episode. Sorry.
Oh, do not worry.
I mean, the stuff with the husks was kind of added last minute.
I love the husks. I love the husks so much. Yeah. They are perfect, and I love them, and I want to give them a hug.
JNT apparently said it didn't feel like it was enough of a Doctor Who story, and it needed monsters.
It needed bug-eyed aliens.
Yeah. in almost like we've come full circle from where back in the original days Sydney Newman was like, no bug-eyed monsters, and here's JNT saying we need more bug-eyed monsters.
Yeah, I really like them. Me and Sam have recently invented a game which is called Which One Is John and Which One Is Martin? And the game is that we hold up two objects or point at two things and explain which one is John and which one is Martin. And I showed her the screen paused on the two asks and she looked at me and she said, which one is John and which one is Martin?
And which one was John and which one was Martin? We must know.
Big bug-eyed alien was John and the other one was Martin.
Yeah, that's right.
Everything inherently has John or Martin vibes, as it turns out. But yeah, I love this cliffhanger. I love the weird stone spaceship. I love the Nigel Neal of it all. It is wonderful.
Stone spaceship is such a great concept.
Yes. Yeah. And the it looks a bit similar to like a vague TARDIS design or a TARDIS design that could have been as well, which I really like.
Nigel Neal. It's Quatermass all over again.
Yep. Are we surprised?
No, I love Quatermass. Mark Platt came into writing Doctor Who from writing fanfic, and he wears all his influences on his sleeve, and I love him for that. He is an icon. Right, episode 2.
Let's do it.
Yes. The Doctor finds Gwendolyn opening drawers containing specimen cases of beetles. She opens a final drawer which contains a man, saying that it's one of her favourites and that it's from Java. Everything seems to be from Java in this serial. She then tells the Doctor that the Reverend Ernest Matthews will be leaving for Java soon and that Uncle Josiah sent her father there after he saw what was in the cellar.
That's at least a really good bit of dialogue that so quickly establishes that going to Java is a euphemism for being killed in some form or being disposed of. And yeah, it's one of the cases of like, this entire serial is really good at its wordplay.
Yeah.
This is something that I discussed with Aim while we were watching it, in that the Doctor uses a lot of aphorisms and common phrases and things like that, and he's using them correctly, which is this nice bit of character arc where, if you remember in his first story, in his regeneration story and a couple of the ones after us, he had a thing where he would misuse aphorisms.
I wish they'd kept that as a trait. I love it.
And now here he is in the final story they recorded, using them all correctly.
Unknowingly that it was the final story as well, so it's a nice little bit of full circle.
There's a horrible little thing in the production notes, which was that when they filmed the last scene, Sylvester McCoy said, "Thanks everyone, see you next year." Oh. And then they didn't.
No! God, going to Java, I just want to point out, sounds like an unreleased Mountain Goats song.
I was saying, like a piece from a musical.
Hey, we're going to Java.
It's a musical about coffee.
In the cellar, the two alien creatures are dragging Ace toward a door. Nimrod appears and comes to her rescue, brandishing a lantern while Ace takes up a stick and fights them off.
The shittest lantern in the universe.
It's the shittest lantern ever. It lasts like 10 seconds.
But also I love getting to see Ace doing fighting.
The Doctor, starting to worry about Ace, begins looking around, but the house matron, suddenly overly friendly, tells him that Ace has gone to bed. Gwendolyn offers to show him. The Doctor moves past them to find Ace, and all the uniformed maids suddenly raise revolvers and aim at him.
I mean, I've always suspected that people in Victorian garb. Are secretly hiding revolvers.
Yeah. Ace continues to swing her stick at the threatening aliens. I love this so much. She will hit. Central to the cellar room is a large oval light divided into many segments, like a fly's eye or something. It's, you know, weird. Brandishing her stick, she threatens, "Let's go or I'll smash it!" This brings about a change of heart in Nimrod, who says she is profaning the Temple of Light and grabs her stick, crying, "The sleeping one must not be woken!" But as they struggle, they strike the oval light and steam bursts from it.
See, this is where I always think it's going to be vampires.
Yeah, I suppose like the sleeping one, it has a very vampiric.
We need more Doctor Who vampires. We've had like 3 Doctor Who vampires, and I want.
And
more.
It's not enough.
Yes.
What we actually need is Go on.
We had Hemivores, we had the woman in Smith and Jones, and we had the Vampires of Venice that were actually fish.
Oh, and don't forget the Tom Baker one.
I will forget the vampires, actually, from the Fourth Doctor. I will be forgetting that.
I could pitch State of Decay. Doctor Who, What We Do in the Shadows crossover.
I was literally just thinking that. I was literally just thinking Doctor Who.
Oh, I'm so glad that the brain cell we share is vibing today.
What We Do in the Time Vortex.
Yes. God, imagine just like a WW-style Doctor Who episode where they're doing bits to camera.
I would love it. And then something perilous happens to the camera crew because you gotta.
Like the bit in Bad Wolf when Nine goes into the diary room in Big Brother and is like, what the fuck is going on?
New companion is a vlogger and keeps doing this as if it were an actual vlog. And then you have a vlog episode.
An alarm goes off in the house, and in the surprise, the Doctor grabs one of the guns, then grabs Josiah Smith, ordering him down the elevator. The Doctor and Smith arrive in the chaotic cellar, and Smith cries that his work in his laboratory could be ruined. Or observatory could be ruined, pardon me. This elevator is crazily, like luxurious. I love it.
Not massively historically accurate for the time.
Oh, of course not.
It was deemed safe by the production staff. That's all that we were talking about.
Yeah, the production staff also nearly killed Ace several times.
Yes.
Poor Sophie Aldred. I'm looking at a history of elevators from top to bottom, excuse me.
I love you.
Yes. In 1846, Sir William Armstrong introduced the hydraulic crane, and by the early 1870s, hydraulic machines began to replace the steam-powered elevator. And then there were a lot of steam-powered elevators for quite a long time. That's terrifying. Let's see. Electric elevators came into use towards the end of the 19th century. The first one was built by the German inventor Werner von Siemens in 1880.
Amazing name.
Yeah. Black inventor Alexander Miles patented an electric elevator, brackets US patent number 371,207, close brackets, on October 11th, 1887. No more information is given on the history of the lift.
I mean,
so there could have been a lift.
Maybe we do need a Doctor Who story, a historical that goes deep into the history of elevators.
I think we need a pure historical, right, exactly like that. Just a pure historical about the history of some mundane electrical object.
Maybe that's the vlog episode and it's called You Lift Me Up.
Hey, we've discovered what Chris Chibnall's final episode is going to be, so.
Yeah, it's going to be that. He's going to disappoint everybody except the three of us, and that's what he's been gunning for the whole time.
We are the target audience.
The target audience. Back in the house, Gwendolyn starts crying, asking why her father went to Java and left her, and wondering where her mother is. Poor Gwendolyn.
It's
she's
very
you sad. Know, she's dealing with things. The Doctor patches the steam leak in the cellar, stabilising the situation. He then identifies Ace's alien attackers as previous incarnations of Josiah Smith, kind of like an insect which casts off its outer husk as it grows. These husks, however, are fully animate and bear little resemblance to humans. I won't lie, I missed this bit. I don't think I was paying attention.
Yeah, that was one of those things that I didn't spot until like a third watch through of this.
I mean, I guess it makes sense. Like, they're wearing the same outfits, and then he starts getting the weird face thing. Like, he's growing out of the husk again.
I mean, like, this whole thing, from my understanding of what's supposed to be going on, is that either light or someone connected to light is trying to do these experiments to monitor how evolution happens on Earth, and which is why you have Control as the sort of control group, as the one who is unchanging. So, like, Josiah is this kind of experiment in how evolution works. That's as far as I could understand it. That's what I think is going on.
Right, right.
I didn't give it that much thought. I just sat there and enjoyed the adventure.
I assumed that they were just a second and a third alien butler, like Nimrod. They're just like Nimrod's underbutlers. Like, Nimrod is the Thomas Barrow, and then they're like the other ones whose names I don't know because I haven't watched Downton Abbey. I do have a very long Downton Abbey fanfiction reread ahead of me, though. I've just opened my reread of one of the fics. I'm very excited for it after we finish the podcast.
Amazing.
It's great. A screen comes up showing DNA and Ace. I swear to God, it was just showing some random equations.
Yeah, I think like the script says it shows DNA, and presumably the set designers didn't know what DNA looked like.
Yeah, it just looks like some random equations.
Yeah, it looks like math.
And Ace realizes they are actually in a stone spaceship. The Doctor says the owner will be displeased when it awakes, but Smith responds that he is the owner. The Doctor retorts that Smith is just part of the cargo. Smith regains the gun and orders the Doctor to stabilize the fluctuating energy before it blows up this part of England. In vying for control, the Doctor reopens the steam patch. Whoa!
Nope.
Whatever is behind the door starts to come out and the others all run for the elevator. On the way up, Smith's appearance starts to change. The Doctor says he is evolving again.
He's like a Pokemon.
Yeah. I do love a bit of Doctor Who evolution. once again, the mutants, of course, being the example of this.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything we wouldn't use that as the prime example of?
No. God, I keep thinking I should rewatch X Serial, and then I'm like, no, I need to watch Ghostlight in the next 3 hours, or I'm not going to be able to record the podcast. I wanted to rewatch Power of the Daleks today. Really sad times for me.
Aww.
I'll get to it eventually. On the main floor, the maids come to help him from the lift. He orders them, "It's first light, secure the house!" The matron tells them to take Smith to the upper observatory. The Doctor tells Ace they won't see them again until nightfall. Ooh.
Again, vampires.
Indeed. Josiah Smith awakens Reverend Matthews from his chloroform-induced sleep, and while Matthews goes straight back to chastising evolutionary theory, Smith feeds him a banana, and it is revealed that Matthews' arms have grown long ape-like hair. When the fuck did that happen?
When everyone was down in the stone spaceship.
I do not remember this.
It's a great little scene, but it just does remind me of those fucking Kirk Cameron creationist videos about
how bananas prove God is real. I forgot he existed.
It's like, maybe if Kirk Cameron sort of considered how hairy his arms are, he would realise.
Once when I was in secondary school, a creationist came in to give a talk, and he was so manipulatively convincing that for about an hour I thought evolution wasn't real.
Oh boy.
Only an hour though, that's okay.
I was very impressionable.
That's how they get you.
That's how they get you.
You got to watch them turn into a monkey on stage, and then that breaks the illusion. Yeah.
He's got to feed me a banana. It's got to make my arms grow ape-like hair, and then I'll believe. Gwendolyn, having seen that it is daylight outside, checks on her Uncle Josiah and finds him still mid-transformation, looking sickly. He drops another dose of chloroform. Yep. He drops another dose of chloroform onto a handkerchief, and Gwendolyn administers it to the metamorphosing Andrews. Metamorphosing Matthews. I said Andrews and I don't know why. Meanwhile, the Doctor opens the drawer with the man inside and wakes him.
Doing his sort of jazz clicky fingers. I mean, that's the way to break someone out of a trance, is to just...
You just click. That's it. That easy.
Are people like how being Ace hypnotized also tries serial? It. Would you say that people are being hypnotized?
Mm, in a sense.
I don't think it's pure enough hypnosis to
I miss hypnosis.
It's been a long time since you've had any hypnosis. Yeah.
I think yes, we can say that there is some hypnosis going in because Gwendolyn and her mother don't recognise each other due to some kind of mental block, which feels like the result of hypnosis of some kind.
I mean, I'll take it. I'll fucking take it, Joel.
Are you desperate for hypnosis?
I'm desperate for hypnosis. You know I love hypnosis.
It feels to me at this point
like a foundational element of Doctor Who.
That's because our first 22 episodes had hypnosis in them.
It's what they should do on the TARDIS wiki page when they have their opening like four statements that are like, here's how to get into Doctor Who. The Doctor, companions, friendship, monsters.
Hypnosis.
The fifth one needs to be hypnotism.
I wrote a fic about the Doctor and the Master having a conversation wherein the Doctor drops the factoid that they were the ones that taught the Master how to hypnotise people.
Oh my gosh.
And regrets it. Because you remember, like, the first Doctor would hypnotise people. He had his little ring and he would, like, hypnotise people with it. And
yeah.
Two does it occasionally and three does it with Agador.
Yes.
So yeah, the Doctor, I think like yeah, the Seventh Doctor hypnotises a couple of people as well.
Yeah, no, hypnotism is an extremely prevalent theme in Doctor Who, we have decided.
Oh, we've discovered through our scientific research.
Yes, yes. Ace awakens in a bed as a maid opens the curtains. She is not one of the uniformed, non-speaking, gun-wielding maids, but a pleasant servant named Mrs. Gross, who is bringing Ace breakfast.
Okay, question. Would you rather be woken up by a regular maid or a gun-wielding maid?
I think probably a regular maid. I'd rather go for gun-wielding. Do you want them to be actively wielding the gun or just have it in a holster?
Oh, just have it. Yeah.
Okay.
Not pointing it at me, but like be prepared to shoot.
I mean, that is one way to get you out of bed in the morning. Point gun.
Get out of bed or I will shoot you with my concealed gun. I am a mild-mannered Victorian skivvy. Enjoy. She tells her it is after 5 and will be getting dark soon, and no one in their right mind stays in this house after dark. The man in the drawer
Ace,
turns out to be
being asleep all day, very, very relatable behaviour from Ace there.
Yeah. The man in the drawer turns out to be a police inspector, Mackenzie, from Scotland Yard, sent to investigate the disappearance of George Pritchard, Gwendolyn's father, in 1881, 2 years previous, and is dead set on conducting his investigation.
Dead set.
And this is our Z-Cars crossover.
Yep. I'm sure we'll get to discussing that
we
later.
We will.
The Doctor is aware that there were two beings in the stone spaceship below the house, one asleep, the master of the ship, and one imprisoned, which was able to get through the door as he rescued Ace and the others. Josiah Smith has been keeping them subdued and using the ship's resources, fearing the ship's master. The explorer read Sven Cooper saw it and lost his mind, and the Neanderthal butler Nimrod worships it. But what is it? This sounds like a riddle.
Riddle me, piss!
The explorer fears it, the Neanderthal worships it. What is it?
Ace hits it with a stick.
Being woken up by a gun-wielding maid.
God. Yeah, I feel like the light has not made as much of an appearance in this TARDIS wiki summary, but there is a bit with Redvers where he's in a straitjacket staring in terror at the fucking snuff box as it opens up and reveals it's full of light, which is presumably the radiation. Doesn't like it. He doesn't like it at all.
It's too much snuff, you know.
Too much snuff will do this. This is your brain on snuff, and they open the box and the light comes out of it. In the meantime,
you wouldn't
Ace
open a radioactive snuff box.
If you feel like opening the radioactive snuff box, talk to Frank. In the meantime, Ace and Inspector Mackenzie make their way to a room where they find Josiah Smith, the matron, Gwendolyn, and the half-ape Reverend Matthews all seated and all inanimate and covered with sheets like furniture in a vacant house. Jesus Christ.
Spooky.
It's really macabre as it goes on.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I was saying, I don't know what's more frightening, the bits where like you see these living people turning into these like taxidermies, or when the taxidermies start coming to life later on.
There's a lot of unpleasant things going on. There's just a lot of bad, is what I would say. The Doctor, wanting to move things along, turns the clock ahead so it strikes midnight, and panels open in the wall, revealing the uniformed maids, who then move silently into the room. Upstairs, the seated figures become animate, and Gwendolyn attacks Ace. The matron knocks Mackenzie down, and he is held by the previous husk of Smith. The new Smith enters the room and has them all go downstairs. There's a lot of action packed into these few minutes.
I love the subtlety, or not quite so subtlety, of the Doctor literally moving time forward. When he's a time traveller. They could have popped into the TARDIS and done this, but no, he goes to the clock and moves it.
He still doesn't trust his own navigational skills, secretly.
That's fair, actually, yeah. You'll notice that there is no interior TARDIS in this
episode. No!
Well,
I did notice
I think the last serial that has the TARDIS interior, I think it might be The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. I might be wrong
really
about
survival,
that.
Battlefield had it.
No. Like, I don't think that you see the TARDIS interior at all in season 26.
You definitely see it in Battlefield.
At the very start.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because they're
in
there, and
then
they start screaming because it's so loud.
Yeah, and it's all dim and dark, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's because like the set was falling apart, and it's not. Yeah, it's like the last appearance of the TARDIS interior.
Sad.
Which is a shame.
Sad. We love you, TARDIS
until
interior.
Until the TV movie.
Which has the perfect TARDIS interior, fight me.
It is very, very, very good. We accept this. Like, I'm loving Doctor Who Flux. I do, like, every time I see a new Who Doctor Who interior, I'm like, but is it the Eighth Doctor movie interior? Like, is it?
Is there a reading nook? No, well, there's 12 nook? Nearly had
Is
one.
There a time rotor that goes up and down? I really miss the time rotor. I miss the time rotor so bad.
When we take over the show.
When we take over the show, after RTD.
Well, 13's time rotor does go up and down. It's just massive.
It's just a big rock, though, in the new episode, isn't it? It's just a massive
rock. It looks like a salt lamp, and I want to lick it.
It's a big salt lamp.
It's a Himalayan salt bit, and she can cook things on it.
Yes.
Maybe she got it from the Himalayas during the Abominable Snowman. Who knows? Any thoughts on my headcanon about the Himalayan
Well,
Himalayan
that would be a great way to reintroduce
I was wondering
the
if
Yeti.
I think that would actually be really funny if Flux tried to fit as many like old monsters in as possible.
I'm begging like for Yetis. Card. I'm begging for Yetis. I realised, because they had the whole swarm thing, right? And people were trying to figure out what the M was. And I was like, Morbius, Mavellans, Marinus, Master. Like, there's a lot. There's a lot.
Imagine if they brought back Marinus.
Ernest
though.
Matthews! I'm calling it now. It's Matthews from A Ghost of Light. He's going to come back with his big hairy arms.
I've seen those arms before. I mean, just while we're here, I would love to request of if anyone from Doctor Who production is listening that day we get a returning villain from the classic series who does not remember the Doctor, and the Doctor is very insulted by this.
They're like, oh yeah.
Yeah, I get. Like, I can imagine. The Doctor, like, remember me?
I can genuinely imagine Isla and Sorg just like vaguely remember a guy who helped them in Paladon, and then
yes,
and they meet up with him again at their like wedding. The Doctor turns up at their wedding and is like, "Hi," and they're like, "I'm sorry, but who are you?
Have we met?"
I would love something like the Celestial Toymaker to return, and then the Doctor's like, but don't you remember me? I beat you in that game. And the Toymaker's just like, that's fucking ages ago, man. You know, I've played lots of games with lots of people. Do you think you're the only one who ever won? You expect me to remember every single person?
I had to give you
person?
So many clues. I had to give you so many clues to solve that pyramid puzzle.
Anyway, let's get back to Ghostlight.
Yeah, probably a good idea.
We have 2 hours, 25 minutes until Doctor Who's on.
The Doctor talks about someone known as Control, one of the beings on the ship who has finally been set free. Out of the lift steps a shrouded figure. The Doctor says, thank you for trusting me, Control. A woman reveals her face and says that what they are desiring will be found in the darkness of the lift. Smith rushes to secure the doors, but is electrocuted when he touches it. The Doctor calls, light! And the doors fly open as a bright light envelops them all. So good. It's so good.
It's one of those stories where the Doctor definitely wants to seem like he's in control of everything and has planned everything out, but it definitely more feels like he's just winging it.
Yeah, which I enjoy. As a sort of dynamic.
They keep saying that he's been doing these things and talking to people and promising them things, but they just haven't put it in the episode. So he goes, oh, I already talked to Control. When? When did you do that?
Show, don't tell.
And, it is and good he, showing, he released, but also, oh my God. Yeah, he released Red Fuzz as well. He's oh yes, the Doctor released me hours ago. Like, did he? Yeah.
The Doctor is very much indicative of Seven's machinations. They're just like, yeah, he does a lot of shit without telling people. We just have to deal with it at this point.
I mean, like, this story does, like, establish... It helps to further establish the Seventh Doctor as this sneaky behind-the-scenes person. I think because we're supposed to identify with Ace, who doesn't see a lot of what the Doctor does, it kind of feels appropriate that we find out that, oh, the Doctor's been doing weird shit behind the scenes and we're only just finding out about it now. Adds to the mystique of the character.
And the frustration.
And yeah. I was just going to bring up the fact that this was filmed after everything else. But I do feel like one of the sort of culminations of a lot of the Doctor Ace relationship comes in Curse of Fenric, where we do get that big kind of confrontation where Ace, like, stays to the Doctor, you keep doing these things and you don't tell anyone. You don't tell me what's going on. How do you expect me to learn if you don't tell me what's going on? Mm. So I like that that is still here in this story. And we've still got that sense of that's what this Doctor is like, even after having these confrontations.
You know, it's fun watching this. And I mean, we talk about Doctor Flux a lot this episode. That's just where we're at. But it's nice to think that 13 is actually a very seven-ish Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, I don't think that's a comparison many people are drawing, but I think we should, because, like, she's so conniving. In a good way. I really love her, but like the way that she doesn't tell Yaz things and Yaz is really frustrated with it, and it's like yes, more of this please.
Yeah. Episode 3. The Doctor helps Control release the trapped creature from the cellar, a being known as Light, who takes the form of an angel-like being, basically glowing golden.
Yeah.
Like the production notes point out that it was originally supposed to have wings, but yeah, they realised they didn't have the budget for it.
Classic. Classic.
It does a lot considering the budget, in fairness.
Mm.
Thousands of years in the past, an alien spaceship came to Earth to catalogue all life on the planet. After completing its task and collecting samples, including Nimrod, the leader, Light, went into slumber. By 1881, the ship had returned to Earth. The year's 1883. While Control remained imprisoned on the ship to serve as the control subject of scientific investigation, events transpired such that Smith, the survey agent, mutinied against Light, keeping him in hibernation on the ship. Smith began evolving into the era's dominant life form, a Victorian gentleman, and also took over the house.
This is such a, like, they literally explain all of this in a piece of dialogue, and it's still like, yeah. What?
What? By 1883,
yeah. I was going to say, yeah, it's a very convoluted story. I really like it.
It's not even that the premise is convoluted. I like the premise. It's that none of this had been communicated until this point.
No.
No.
Like, retroactively, you're like, oh, okay. But none of it had come up beforehand.
I mean, like, there's like quotes from the writer who's like, oh, he doesn't want to give everything out on a silver plate to the viewer, but give us something.
By 1883, Smith had lured and captured the explorer Fenn Cooper within his den. Utilising Fenn Cooper's association with Queen Victoria, he plans to get close to her so he can assassinate her and take control of the British Empire to make it a better place.
That is how the monarchy works.
Discuss. Yeah.
The one who kills the queen becomes the queen. I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
Oh, in which case we've got a race against time.
Yeah. I mean,
she's going to be dead by the time this episode works.
But she's got to be dead, right? Guys, ding dong, the witch is dead.
Imagine if she's not, though.
Oh, God. I mean, she is. They're just propping her up like fucking Weekend at Bernie's at this point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she died in 1982,
I think. Prince Philip was dead a full 2 weeks before they announced it, surely.
Two years.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. But that was when they reanimated him using, like, a Frankensteinian sort of situation.
Yes, the necromancy is the heart of the British monarchy.
It's when they start doing things like, you know, suspiciously, whenever the Queen makes an appearance, there's just a very large cardboard box or something just standing there, and they said the Queen, who is totally just standing behind this box right now.
Yeah, it's so mysterious how she only ever appears while between two people who are right next to her.
She just walks out of a coffin
just over there. Yeah,
she's been wearing roller skates a lot recently. I guess it makes it easier for her to move around.
I do like the sunglasses she's chosen, though.
Yeah, no, I know, it's so interesting.
And the flies that just follow her, it's such a fashion choice.
Guys, we have to finish this recap.
Yes.
Light is displeased by all the change on the planet while he was asleep. Same. While Light tries to make sense of it all, Smith tries to keep his plan intact, but events are beyond his control. Angry that his catalogue is now missing the correct information, Light childishly decides to destroy all organic life to stop evolution after taking apart one of the maze to understand how humans work. He turns Gwendolyn and her missing mother, revealed to be Lady Pritchard, to stone in a bid to stop the speed of evolution. I'm no scientist. I don't know if that's how it works.
Yeah, I mean, the petrification is like, come on, guys. But the effect is fucking good, though. When they start with the stone is creeping up their hands.
Yeah.
It does also raise the question, is this the first planet Light went to make a catalogue.
Oh, probably not.
I think
evolution happens on other planets.
What happened? This is my guess, right? Because he went to sleep here. My guess is he was assigned like 5 planets to do. He went through the first 4. He got to the 5th one. He was like, great, I'm going to take a nap. And then he went to sleep for 2 million years. And he woke up and he was like, what the fuck is this? And he hasn't even gone back to the other planets to check. So he thinks evolution is a uniquely Terran concept.
I like that.
I like it when the enemy is an idiot.
Inspector McKenzie meets a sticky end and is turned into a primordial soup to serve at dinner. Ew.
Yuck. Blech. It's like, and it's so brown. It just looks...
And Light's like, and we will do this to all of Earth, and Ace is just horrified.
Yeah.
As Control tries to evolve into a lady, is this... Yep. Well. And Ace tries to come to grips with her feelings about the house. The Doctor tries to keep the upper hand in all the events that have been set in motion.
Another reference to Pygmalion coming up here. Yeah.
We started the rain off in with Spain falls mainly down the drain.
Yeah, they started off with a Pygmalion reference calling Ace Eliza in the first episode. And in this episode we have the rain in Spain stays mainly.
God, we do have that great line from the Doctor where he's like, oh, things are getting out of control. Even I can't play this many games at once.
Yeah.
The Doctor finally convinces Light of the futility of opposing evolution, which causes him to overload and dissipate into the surrounding house. It was this presence that Ace sensed and which caused her to burn the house down in 1983.
Yeah, the Doctor just constantly points out changes that are occurring.
Haven't you changed your
You've just changed your location and you've changed your mind. And you're like, oh my God.
What's the matter? Changed your mind?
Also, Control's complete evolution into a lady derails Smith's plan as Fern Cooper, having freed himself from Smith's brainwashing, chooses to side with her. In the end, with Smith, the new Control creature, imprisoned on the ship, Control, Fern Cooper, and Nimrod set off in the alien ship to explore the universe. Yeah. That is the spin-off I need.
I know, big finish, get fucking on
Please.
It.
Please. The Doctor asks Ace if she has any regrets about the burning the house down now. Ace tells him she wished she blew it up instead. The Doctor only smiles and says, wicked.
To remain in this universe, the creature would have to reverse its polarity.
I love it. It's nonsense. It's chaotic. It's silly. It's dramatic. Yeah, I love it.
It is Gothic. A primordial soup of concepts that have been beautifully arranged for us.
I mean...
I don't entirely understand it, but a lot of the elements feel like they were created explicitly for me.
It is a very Amesian kind of story, I think.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the story is notorious among Doctor Who fans for being, like, inscrutable. And it is, but that doesn't mean that it's not enjoyable and good.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff going on.
It's entertaining to watch. It's entertaining to allow yourself to be swept along with.
It's visually
even
interesting.
Even if you don't understand it.
It's very visually interesting, and the costume. Again, it's one of those things where it's in a particular historical context where the BBC obviously had props and costumes ready.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to spend a lot of money on them.
An apple a day keeps the... No, never mind.
Shall we talk about our little Scottish man, the Doctor?
Yes! Our little Scottish man!
I enjoy... He's just like a little grumpy Scottish man who seems particularly distant at the start of the first episode for reasons I can't quite understand.
He's off stage. He's just ADR.
Sylvester McCoy wasn't in yet, you know, he was still putting his costume on.
Yeah, he was literally shouting from the dressing room, Ace, what megaphone. Can you see out there?
Ace, I'll be there in 5.
Ace!
Well, like, in context, this is just after Battlefield. So maybe, I mean, like, at the end of Battlefield, they go off shopping, don't they? Oh, no, Ace and the others go off shopping.
Oh, yeah, he's just had to make lunch.
He's had to make lunch and use a lawnmower.
Catch up with his old boyfriend.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe that's what he's thinking about. Maybe that's why he's so distant. He's just like, oh, I should have brought the brig with us.
Yeah.
I know he was happy with Doris, but he should have come with us.
God, imagine if the last 3 serials of season 26 just had the Brigadier in them inexplicably.
Galaxy Brain take!
That would be really good. Oh, what would the brig be up to in this serial? So many good things.
Snarking.
You'd just be going around shouting at everything.
Yeah, but in the best possible way. I love him.
Now, see here, Mr. Light, I don't much approve of you.
You can't be so far against change. All of these things are changing all the time. You just have to accept that.
My moustache has changed. It used to be a fake moustache, now it's a real moustache.
God, I love Nicholas Courtney so much. He's not in this serial, though. Focus, Sylvester McCoy.
Sir, not appearing in this serial.
Yes. Sylvester McCoy, he's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
He is so good. He is so interesting.
Like, this characterization of the Doctor, I find so interesting. Especially, like, given how McCoy was kind of directed to play the Doctor in his first series as very kind of happy-go-lucky little scamp. Whereas he's you know, turning into this manipulative chess master character that I love so much. And here he is, like, this is kind of his final form, almost.
Mm.
Absolutely. Like, the development of Seven is so interesting. Mm. Just the way that they went, you know what, no one is giving us any money, no one cares what Doctor Who is doing, let's just go full morally ambiguous Doctor. It's been so
long.
Let's
get weird up in here.
Let's get strange.
I mean, we probably could. I mean, I think you're right that, like, 13 has a lot of Seven vibes, and I think that, like, you can draw a comparison into how a lot of people talk about the Seventh Doctor as being, oh, he's so cool and manipulative and chess mastery, and where 13 is doing the same things and the same people get very annoyed, like, oh, she should be kinder, she should be nicer. Like, well, you didn't seem to mind it when the Seventh Doctor was doing this.
Yeah, let me tell you something, it's because she's a woman.
That's so mysterious. I wonder why. No, Aim, it can't be because she's a woman, because they're not sexist, Aim. They just don't think she's very good at being the Doctor, you know? There's no
reason.
It's
about ethics in Doctor Who writing.
In our mockumentary, I'm staring straight into the camera.
Yep. It is fascinating. I mean, there are people who don't like the Seventh Doctor because of those manipulative vibes, but you can't say that it's not the intentional characterization, right? Like,
Yeah.
Oh, good shit.
I mean, like, I think we talked about this a bit when we did the TV movie, that it is entertaining that he is this manipulative game-playing Doctor who has so many kind of schemes all going at once, and he dies by just getting shot.
He almost gets shot in this one. He's so close to getting shot.
I mean, he puts himself in these situations, to be fair. But, like, when he got shot in the TV movie, he hadn't put himself in that situation.
No. Yeah, he was just popping out for a walk.
Yeah.
I mean, have you read the stuff about what, like, one of the planned regeneration stories for Seven was?
No.
I vaguely recall this, that he was going to be on some distant planet getting sort of mind warped in some capacity, and was like, his whole, like, his brain was being manipulated, and that was how he he died, because his, like, he couldn't control his own sanity or something like that.
Oh boy.
I'm trying to remember what it was called now, but yeah, it sounded really interesting. That, like, the Doctor Who's had the most of this kind of mind gamey story arc would be undone by having his sanity, like, ripped away from him, and, like, the only way he can survive is to regenerate. I think that was, like, the basic gist of it. I mean, question remains about whether or not such stories would have made it to production without considerable changes, because this story was originally Lungbarrow.
Yeah,
I'm sure we'll get onto. And anyone who's read Lungbearer will notice that there are significant differences between that and this. But yeah, I love the Seventh Doctor. He's great.
Yeah. He's, I've got a little image that I think normal, like, sums him up.
Pop it in the...
It's in the notes.
That one. It's a little kitten. A little kitten. And it says, normalize being sneaky. A scheming little scamp.
I just love how anarchic Seven is. Like, this, like, I think he is firmly anti-establishment in the best way. Like, there's a bit where Josiah says, this is when he says, Josiah, tell me about your plan to assassinate Queen Victoria. Classic shit. Josiah is like, the British Empire is an anarchic mess. There's no clear directive from the throne and no discipline, etc. The Doctor says, confusion, wastage, tyranny, burnt toast, till all the Atlas is pink. He hums Rule Britannia. It's like he's not technically against them assassinating Queen Victoria in, like, principle. He just knows that Queen Victoria does not get assassinated, and therefore he's sort of morally obligated to stop it from happening.
It's like, tell me about your plan to assassinate Queen Victoria, and how can I get in on this action? You
know? Yeah, I'd love to get in on it. Let me know how I can help.
Oh yeah, you've noted down the great line is that I'm as human as you are. Yes.
He just has so many good lines in this. It's wonderful. I love him. I love him so much. All doctors are good doctors. Seven is very good doctor.
If you've read anything else written by
Mark Bart?
No, not him. Who was the script editor guy?
Andrew Cartmell?
Andrew Cartmell. I feel like a lot of those one-liners come from him, because like he does a lot of those like sneaky lines in his other works. He's written a few Torchwood books that feel very Seventh Doctor-y.
I nearly met him once, in the sense that I was in the same room as him, but I'd just run across Plymouth to get to meet Sophie Aldred. So I was like out of breath, like, Sophie Aldred, I love you!
I've met him. I've met him a couple of times. He's really nice.
And I hope Sophie Aldred also expressed her love for you.
I'm sure she did. I barely remember it, but I have my side photo, so, yeah.
Aww.
I have to go.
Now look, if you're going to be in trouble, you'll need me to look after you.
Me too.
But you don't understand.
Yeah.
But yes. Oh, yes. I love her. Have I mentioned this? Is this news to anyone?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you've mentioned that at all.
Well, I fucking adore her.
She is beautiful.
Again, like, this is where Ace's storyline is really starting to sort of crest that wave towards its peak, which I think it reaches in Curse of Fenric, but also in Survival. Because Curse of Fenric is more kind of explicitly about Ace's relationship with her mother, etc. And I suppose Survival is about her relationship with Perivale and like the mundane in general, and her discovering her lesbian identity. And furry identity.
Yeah. hang on. I have in Inside the TARDIS, The Worlds of Doctor Who, there's a quote about, a very short quote about a theme of the last season. A theme of the last season especially is her growing awareness of her own sexuality.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Although I think the way that they phrase this does not quite work, because they're like, which causes her to try on girl clothes in Ghostlight. She doesn't try on the girl clothes. They are provided to her. She wears the tuxedo because she's a butch lesbian. We accept
this.
I mean, there is that scene from Silver Nemesis where they see that painting of presumably a future Ace who's like wearing a Victorian dress. Which is one of those things where I'm like, were they ever going to do something with that? I don't know.
Who knows? Who knows?
I really like the drama of her storyline in the episode and how angry she is about it as well.
She's just
like
so
her fury
angry
at the Doctor is something that could otherwise be muted for, again, very mysterious reasons.
It's extremely good.
Yeah. I just adore that she gets to go there and go that hard on it.
Yeah, one of the things I really love about their relationship is that they do have these big fights, both in this and in Curse of Fenric, where they properly go at each other, and like Ace especially like calls him out on all of his bullshit, and yet they still remain friends afterwards. They are able to kind of have these massive disagreements and still trust each other to an extent, and Ace still kind of has this respect for the Doctor, it's like not a blind respect, it's not a kind of like people often like compare them to, like, it's almost like a grandfatherly relationship he has to her, but it's very much not like the Doctor's relationship to Susan, because I don't think you get a lot of Susan.
I think there's a lot more of like,
it's more like
actively trying to mentor.
Yeah, it's a student mentor thing, like 12 and Bill, which is also very similar because it is grumpy Scottish doctor with lesbian companion,
which is obviously the ideal setup.
Yes, obviously the ideal setup. Definitely like a student mental thing. And yeah, there is very much a thing where the Doctor is almost like covertly encouraging her to get mad at him. Like, he wants her to question his authority, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it. Especially given, like, what Cartmel's plan was with sending Ace to Time Lord school.
Yeah.
If the Doctor is, like, teaching her to always question authority, even himself, that's clearly something that's contributed to the Doctor leaving Gallifrey and his continued attitude towards the Time Lords. Which I think, like, is something we've kind of missed in New Who.
It's something I hope we get in Flux.
Yeah, the kind of, like, the Doctor... I mean, we get a little bit of it in The End of Time where as soon as the Doctor realises that the Time Lords are coming back, he picks up a gun.
He's like, no, fun. I missed them, but I don't want them back.
Yeah, but even that, it's like kind of treating them with this kind of reverence that they're this big threat. Whereas I like the Doctor that's like, the Time Lords, oh, fuck's sake, the Time Lords.
Oh, the bureaucracy is coming. Yeah. They're going to make me fill in a form.
Yeah, I've always liked that as being like part of the Doctor's driving force behind leaving Gallifrey, being like, oh, it's so boring. All they do is watch things and they don't do anything. I hate it. And when they do things, it's rubbish. The fucking CIA coming in here with their delusions of grandeur.
Ugh.
I'm glad that the CIA seem to be making a reappearance in Flux, incidentally, the 13th Doctor's run with the Division, which seems to be a kind of proto-celestial intervention agency.
Yeah. It's all very strange. God, speaking of reverence for things, though, Ace does not fucking care that they're in history. She has no interest in history whatsoever. It's so good.
Yes. Like, yeah, and like...
Oh. She's like, oh, from Victorian times. Okay, I'm going to wear a suit.
I wonder if she's at this stage playing with how much she can get away with.
Mm.
Good.
Yeah,
scratch the Victorian veneer and something nasty will come crawling out. It's so good.
A lot of this feels like, I mean, I think this was in the production notes, that some of this is kind of a reference to Thatcher, who like would lean on old Victorian values.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And like hold that up as like this example of superior morals, etc. And this is Doctor Who saying, nope, fuck Thatcher.
As it should.
Yes.
I like that she's a lethal arsonist.
Mm-hmm.
Lethal burning down things. Always wants to do an explosion. Bang, bang, bang. I love her.
She does, in fact, deserve a little arson as a treat. Like
every day. Make sure that you give your ace an arson as a treat.
Yeah, like she burns down Gabriel Chase in direct response to traumatic event of her friend being either seriously injured or killed in a firebombing incident.
It's by like, white nationalists, yeah.
Yeah. So she goes and she finds a house that is an ancient haunted Victorian house that was full of people who didn't want people to progress. And she's like, I'm getting a bad vibe from this place. I'm going to burn it the fuck down right now. Like,
I love her.
She is the best.
I want that energy for me.
It's such a great thing as well, because like, I think that there would be this compulsion, like lesser writers would have had this be about how, oh, Ace, you shouldn't go around burning down buildings, it's very bad. Whereas this is like, no, Ace was perfectly right to burn down this building.
I wish I'd blown it up instead, as the closing line from her. Great.
It's such a great, kind of example of the anarchism of Doctor Who, which is, you know, this isn't a exploration of Ace learning that she was wrong. It's more Ace learning like the deeper nuances of why she was right all along. Mm-hmm. It's the Doctor like giving her some validation in his weird twisted way.
And the other bit I don't think we mentioned is the bit at the start where she says hello to the taxidermy.
Oh,
yeah, it's so good. And then she's like, she responds as she's leaving, like, oh, see you later. It's like, oh my god. So Ace. Cute. I would also do that.
Yeah.
And it's the theme of things being held in stasis in the house, like things unchanging. It's good.
Mm.
On your knees, Doctor.
Ace's girlfriend of the week.
Yes.
An essential part. I really like her.
An evil girlfriend.
I think she's very pretty. I think proportionally, Ace has more evil girlfriends than non-evil girlfriends, and I love it for her.
Oh, let's make a count, shall we? She doesn't have an evil girlfriend in... Okay, she does sort of in Dragonfire, in that Ace and Mel, you could say. Mel is Ace's first girlfriend of the week.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mel has a girlfriend of the week in Delta and the Bannerman, so she's just passing the torch.
Yeah.
And the girlfriend of the week there was Proto-Ace, so...
Yeah. I was actually thinking about the Delton with the baby.
Were you? Yeah, that makes more sense.
I don't think she has one in Remembrance of the Daleks, unfortunately.
No, there's too much fascism going on. She has a love interest of the week who turns out to be a Nazi.
And she punches him, I think.
And she punches him, and then he dies. And then she goes to his funeral and is like, this fucking sucks.
That's not... Happiness Patrol, she has a whole group of girlfriends.
Yeah, the bit on the bed, as AIM has noted, or Joel has noted, I'm not sure, but...
Oh, that was me. I'm sorry. The bit on the bed was like, yes!
Yeah, there's a bit where Ace and Gwendolyn are having a physical fight, and Ace gets pushed back onto the bed and Gwendolyn straddles her.
It's hot.
It's erotic, yeah. It's sexy.
It's not the sort of thing I'd expect from 80s Doctor Who.
No.
There was only one
like
bed.
It was like fucking Amok Time or something.
Oh boy, yeah, that's I just love that they're letting Ace be very gay.
But yeah, like Ace and Gwendolyn, they go off, they dress up together, maybe they kiss while they're doing that, I don't know.
There is a bit in Curse of Fenric where the two girlfriends that Ace gets in Curse of Fenric, like the writers wanted, like Ian Briggs wanted them to be gay, like he like was subtly putting that in, not thinking John Nathan Turner would notice. And then apparently during one of the script meetings, as they were going on to one of their scenes, John Nathan Turner went, okay, let's go to the lesbians. It's like, I'm glad that that's the case, but you know, maybe Ian Briggs hadn't quite clocked that John Nathan Turner
known gay John Nathan Turner.
God, it's this episode. It has quite a few characters, but a lot of them are more like in like the Doctor's Wife, where the characters are like concepts. So you can't ship as many of them. However, it should be noted that all of the characters in this story are gay as fuck.
Like what's the guy at the beginning with the fancy name?
Renver.
His hair.
Thingamy.
Yeah, his queer energy.
Yeah, he's going into the jungle to find his long lost boyfriend.
He's having a breakdown, which is very queer culture of him.
Yes. And he wants to kill the queen.
He does want to.
Which
kill
is
the
very
queen.
Gay.
Yeah. The light special effects are not straight, as AIM has noted.
Light is very gay.
It's not quite the mutants level of Rainbow Ball of Justice,
God.
But it's Light and Kai should kiss.
Oh yes, they should. Oh my God, Kai turns up and is like, "I'm going to help you out now. Excuse me.
I will teach you how to be a homoerotic ball of light.
Yes.
Come with me.
Come with me to the world of imagination."
Yeah, I don't think I have the authority to say that like everybody with a soft voice who glows in colourful light is gay, but it's not straight.
Yeah.
It's like, this the gayest episode we've had in a while. We've had like a long, like a dry run of queerness, and this
We established that cowboys are gay last time, but yeah, it wasn't super gay.
I don't think that's something that Doctor Who brought to the table.
Yeah, it might have been Stones of Blood was our previous gayest one because of the lesbians.
I don't know if I had a break. When was that?
That was in August.
Okay. It was in August, but it feels like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of season 26
Sorry,
have you done?
Sorry, I had surgery.
Have you done Battlefield?
We've done this in Battlefield.
Ooh.
Yep. The rest aren't even on the radar yet.
I think Curse of Fenric and Survival are very gay as well, so.
Yeah. I think anything with Ace in it is initially more gay, but the fact that they lean into it means we can discuss more than just her queerness.
Yeah.
Love that for us.
Excellent stuff.
You're one of these television chaps, then?
I am no sort of chap, sir.
I just had one note for the gender section, which we've already discussed at length, which is just the fact that they're wearing suits. It's like they're in a fucking musical being male impersonators. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It is very gender of them.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about control as well, and like being so obsessed with becoming, as she says, ladylike, is kind of interesting to me, in that she doesn't feel her gender until she performs it, as it were.
See, I read that as more of a class thing than a gender thing.
There's that too, yeah.
That's because I considered that as well, but it very much reads as, I want to be a lady so I fit in with the setting rather than a lady so I fit in with the gender.
She doesn't want to, she no longer wants to be a control subject, she wants to change.
She wants to be an individual.
And the thing that she idealizes is the pretty outfits and the being respected and listened to. And she's like, well, the best way to do that for me is to learn elocution. And to wear a lovely dress and have nice hair. And as
there are definitely some trans vibes there.
Yes, a little bit.
But I don't think that's the dominant theme.
No. There's certainly a level of like gender as a performance in this one that I really enjoy.
Definitely, yeah.
Like, Light as a character is extremely ambiguously, like, androgynous, despite the actor being, you know... not as
and he's putting on this quite high voice as well.
Yeah, the concept it's very of angelic. The embodiment of Light as an angelic alien, very ambiguous, very androgynous, very, if the, like, it's Axon. He looks like an Axon.
That's yeah.
And like the Axons like supposedly had a binary gender system, but like realistically,
yeah,
they were all big blobs pretending to be humanoids. So
even when they were in their quote unquote humanoid forms, they clearly had no genitals.
And
or
like Light
any
chose
secondary
this
sex.
Form. So Light could have chosen any form, like, you know, whatever. Back to the Third Doctor again, like in the Time Monster, where we find out that Kronos can be anything, because the Time Monster is an iconic genderfuck story.
Yes. And I love the Time Monster.
It's very good.
People say it's shit, but it's not. They're wrong.
Well, I don't remember because I didn't edit our episode on that one. We just released it.
That should be a game we play. Can people tell which ones we don't edit?
Probably? Oh, they absolutely can tell. One day I'll go back and finish editing the Time Monster.
Oh, don't worry about it.
It'll be a Patreon exclusive.
Oh, sure. Lots of people.
And there's a woman!
A woman? Hey!
I mean, my wife is ace. I'm very sorry. I have nothing more to elaborate on. I adore her. I love her. Might as well just put looking for somebody like ace out of Doctor Who on my dating profile at this stage.
I'm shocked that you haven't.
I mean, currently it's just talking about what we do in the shadows. It basically changes from whatever my brain is occupied with.
That's valid.
Shall we? I forgot to bring this up. In episode one of Doctor Who Flux, Nitro 9 is brought up.
Yes!
Oh, yes, it was!
Oh my God.
Yes!
And then when she's trying to release the handcuff, she goes, release!
The caption said Seventh Doctor voice.
It's so good. There were some very good bits of fan service in this episode, and I'm very.
But it's the good fan service as well, where it rewards rather than panders, and I will sit down and eat that all day long.
Nitro 9's unreliable. It is unreliable. Ace, you said 10 seconds. God, Yaz and Ace would get along so well. Imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yaz and Ace should kiss.
Yaz and Ace should kiss. Oh my God. Sorry, I don't mean to shout.
No, you're welcome to. It's fine.
God. It's so nice being excited for like new Doctor Who, you know?
I know.
It feels like it's been ages. Fuck. Actually, like, the last time I got like super excited for Doctor Who was, I think it was the 2 seconds after I heard the phrase, or should I say, spy master.
Yes!
Yeah, I know, because you repeated
like,
that
I
scene for an entire
board.
Week.
I was on board for everything going forward forever. I was like, yes.
We'd get in the car and the first thing that Joel would do, put on the soundtrack from that scene. Lasted about 3 months.
Well, the thing is that Sacha Dhawan is extremely sexy and a very good master, and I hope he's back this season. There's nothing saying that he can't be.
Russell, keep him. Keep him, Russell.
Yeah, Russell, God, please, stop switching master actors. We can just keep the
look at Anthony Ainley. He stuck around for fucking ages.
Yeah, God.
I saw that Tumblr ass we got the other day that referred to the classic Doctor Who master.
God.
We were like, but who?
We got a Tumblr ask. Yes, Gwendolyn is very on board with the suit's plan, and she sings a song. She sings a song.
We love it when people sing in Doctor Who.
It's very Victoriana, you know, she's accomplished. She probably went to finishing school.
Oof, she must have.
Yeah. She's great. She's a little bit evil. She's like, the Doctor says, I wouldn't mind so much about her sending people to Java, but she didn't have to enjoy it quite so much.
I mean, it's like, I don't think there are a lot of Doctor Who stories where there is singing. And the Gunfighters is the only other one that's coming to mind. But, you know, a Doctor Who musical would not go amiss.
Oh, mate, do it like the musical episode of Buffy. That is our podcast. Our podcast is just the musical episode of Doctor Who. Next episode, when we do the Gunfighters, we sang.
Okay, here's my pitch. Last of the Rhyme Lords.
Oh my god.
This is when we need to get Lin-Manuel Miranda involved.
Oh god.
The problem is
Doctor Who and the Pirates, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan pastiche.
Oh, I'm not a massive Gilbert and Sullivan fan. My music teacher at school really loved Gilbert and Sullivan, no! And it felt like torture to me as a 12-year-old, and it's just stuck.
Oh.
What I'm scared of is that they will say there's going to be a musical episode, and then they'll say, in the style of Cats 2019.
I would be the only person excited about it in the world.
Imagine the budget. It would just be survival, but they'd dub it.
I have that movie on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I just can't elaborate on the wives this episode. We already talked about Ace extensively. Gwendolyn is very pretty and she is Ace's wife, and then Control is not wife, but she is my best friend. And beyond that, I'm a bit like, I'm wifed out, you know?
At least we did have more women than that who spoke.
Yes.
Yeah, there's Gwendolyn's
which is nice.
Mother.
There's lots of women in this serial. Thank you, Mark Platt.
Mm.
We just wouldn't wife some of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is okay. You've been very, very. We don't need to fuck every woman.
Yeah, this is the thing. It's like you get to say, oh, it's not just every woman in Doctor Who, you know.
Exactly. Just because we're lesbians doesn't mean we fuck every single woman.
How many stories with Leela have you done so far?
None,
I think.
None.
Still haven't. We've got her coming up soon. I think we've got. She's in Talons of Wen Chiang.
Oh boy.
Which is our first Leela. Oh no.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. Yeah.
Oh fuck.
Today's science fiction so often becomes tomorrow's science fact.
So, firstly, the Nightmaids were played by professional dancers who were cast because they moved like they were drifting, just to add to that spooky, spooky ambience we all love so much.
Nice connection to the Daleks, who are based off dancers who moved like they were gliding.
Yes!
The Maids proto-Daleks.
Yes.
No.
Definitely.
Would I like it if they were? Yes.
They evolve into the Daleks, miraculously.
It mentions that I think Josiah is Dean of Mortarhouse College in Oxford.
I thought it was Merton College.
No, it's Mortarhouse.
It's a made up one, like St. Sense
So another made up Oxford Sharda. College.
In Sharda and also
he
in
might have been. Had he existed, he might have been quite similar, worked closely with John Obadiah Westwood, who was the professor of entomology at the time. But Westwood was also not a Darwinian. He did not like evolution.
Well, there you go. Was he a Lamarckian? Was he a Lamarckian scholar?
I don't know much more about it other than he organized bug collections.
Time Lords have two hearts because they love so much.
Aww.
Anyway, the story evolved out of an earlier rejected script, speaking of Time Lord anatomy, entitled Lung Barrow.
Woo!
It was to be set on Gallifrey in the Doctor's ancestral home and deal with the Doctor's past, but producer John Nathan Turner felt it revealed too much of the Doctor's origins.
Tragic.
Chris Chibnall looked at that and said, coward.
Yeah, he really did.
Reworked.
I admire him for that in a way.
Same. It was reworked to make evolution and the idea of an ancient house central to the story. Mark Platt used elements of his original idea for his Virgin New Adventures novel, Lung Barrow, and we're going to have to read that at some point for our What's the Deal with Looms, Am I Right? bonus episode.
What's the deal with looms? Like, yeah, obviously we're going to have to do that. We're going to have to do like a whole Time Lord anatomy and reproduction episode. I think that'll be very fun.
I remember after the Timeless
Time
Children...
Time Lord Sex Ed.
Time Lord Sex Ed!
After the Timeless Children aired, there was a good tweet I saw where someone said, there's definitely something looming over the canon
right now. No, 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 no.
Looms are canon. They just are cowards and they won't say it, but they are canon.
Looms are canon. They're also horrific.
I've known about looms since primary school and I have no idea where I gained this knowledge.
This explains quite a lot about you as a person.
We had a copy of Longbarrow in our school library.
My mum used to own a copy of Longbarrow and I'm like, Mum, where did you give it? Because it would be worth so much money.
So this story had working titles of The Bestiary and Life Cycle. Platt also briefly jokingly referred to the story as Not the Bestiary when Nathan Turner, disliking the title Bestiary, asked him to change it.
Not the Bestiary, he's a very naughty boy.
Platt described the story as The Addams Family on Acid, which
yeah,
I
that
love.
Tracks. Nice.
Great pitch, great elevator pitch. Mm. So we referred to this earlier. Apparently the actor who played the cop was also played a cop with the same name in Zedcars. So this is our official Doctor Who Zedcars
yes!
crossover episode.
Mm.
Which we've all been waiting for.
Finally!
How far did you get with your Zedcars?
I literally got like 5 minutes into an episode. I was like, this is boring as shit.
You were so excited about it.
I was excited about finding a full episode. I ended up watching Adam Adamant Lives instead, and that fucked. So, like, highly recommend Adam Adamant Lives.
What a weird show.
It's so good.
Tom Baker is in an episode of Zedcars. I don't know if it's one of the ones that still exists.
I don't know. But, Joel.
But if this
Joel,
establishes that they Joel, take place in the same universe.
Joel, have you watched Adam Adamant Lives?
I have not.
It's so fucking good.
We have to go into Adam Adamant again.
It's so fucking good. We haven't gone down that road already, if you think about it, because this episode is definitely being recorded before the gunfight is. It's Donald Cotton's other project. It's like Sleepy Hollow, the TV show, except that it's about an Edwardian spy who gets frozen in a big block of ice inexplicably and buried underneath a house in London and then gets dug up in the 1960s. And it's
come back next
so
time for more
good.
Adam Adamant.
I know Big Finish are doing a audio series of it.
Yeah. It's incredible.
What aren't Big Finish doing a series of now?
I don't know. I did find out recently that Dan Dare has a series, but it's not on Big Finish, the Dan Dare one specifically. I don't know if it's on Dan Dare now, like, but I need to tell my dad about the Dan Dare series because he's a big Dan Dare head. he's a Stan Dare.
What else have I got on my list? Ghostlight was the last serial of the original series ever produced. The last recorded sequence was the final scene between Mrs. Pritchard and Gwendolyn, where, before the eyes of a horrified Nimrod, light turns them to stones, they'll never change again, which is kind of a poetic last scene, putting immortalizing thing, making a thing static before never picking it up. I say never picking it up because I think of New Who as a different continuation.
Yeah, it's very different.
It's not the same tradition. And during the early stages of the development, Light was silent and had wings, which he used to smother the maid in part 3. The latter element was abandoned due to the concerns that it could not be effectively realized. I really want to see somebody killed by wings.
Absolutely robbed. Absolutely.
Probably
robbed.
Happened.
I mean,
yeah.
Anyone who's listened to Paul McCartney,
fucking hell, Joel.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
That's how John Lennon really died.
I was going to say it probably happened on Supernatural.
I was interested by some of the behind the scenes stuff about the Victorian literary sources for the story.
Mm. Yeah, I saw that you were starting to put that in the critique, so I let that.
Yeah, I mean, we can discuss that more later, but I am very interested by the way that it uses Victorian aesthetics without necessarily engaging with actual contemporary Victorian themes. Mm. Besides
how things
the
become parodies of themselves.
Yeah, but no, that's, yeah. As always, AIM, thank you very much for taking us behind the curtain.
Mm. Oh, I like it behind the curtain. It's quite warm and nobody can see me.
That's very good.
No, we'll all go. Except Miss Shaw.
Oh, just a minute. I'm not going to miss all...
No, Miss Shaw.
Have you never heard of female emancipation?
Liz, this time I think he's right.
I mean, on the topic of the Victorian aesthetic and stuff, I mean, going back to the idea that this is kind of critiquing the Thatcherite view of the Victorian era as this kind of moral paragon... this is something I think Doctor Who does really well, which is when it takes a historical figure or historical concept and kind of puts it in a different light. No pun intended. And like says, you know, this thing that we all learned about in school, maybe it isn't as simple as we all thought it was, or maybe, you know, things weren't quite what we thought they were. I like it when Doctor Who does that. Which I think of why I didn't have quite so much truck with a lot of Stephen Moffat's historicals, where, like, for example, the one I often turn to as the worst is his version of Churchill, rather than being a sort of challenge to the popular view of Churchill. It's, no, you're right to believe that Churchill was always good and always great and never did anything racist or horrible or misogynistic in his life. So the cultural view of Churchill is completely right and should never, ever be challenged. If I was writing Richard of the Daleks, Churchill would have been complicit with the Daleks. So...
I wouldn't have put Churchill in it. Putting Churchill in it was such a fucking bizarre choice.
I think... if you're going to put Churchill in it, you do it for a reason of saying he was a shit.
This story is going for Victorian horror vibes, and to what extent does it succeed at emulating Victoriana, Penny Dreadful, Gothic horror vibes in the story?
My argument is that it doesn't.
Yes, my argument is also that it doesn't, but not in a bad way, just in a different
way.
Yeah,
it's still an enjoyable vibe, but if it's going for that, it does not succeed.
Yeah, like... my understanding, and obviously I'm not an expert in Victoriana or anything like that, but I did read The Cultural History of the Ghost, which was really good.
Really good. I love that book.
And my understanding is that Victorian ghost stories are more likely to be rooted in the fear of death or the fear of decay or the fear of industrialization more than they are about the fear of evolution or scientific advancement.
It's a modern take on it using the aesthetic.
Yeah, so it's very much they're using a contemporary social problem that was argued about, and definitely people were arguing about the existence of the soul and how we were, you know, they were like trying to figure out whether souls existed physically, and if they did, what did they weigh, and all these kinds of things, like the use of the scientific method to prove religious concepts. Whereas this story doesn't really try and engage with the mixture of science and religion at all. And it presents
and it doesn't even really engage with religion as theology other than as social concept.
It presents them as diametrically opposed, which most people, even in the Victorian period, who believed in evolution, still believed that God did it. The sort of modern conception of the rational atheist versus the irrational creationist Christian does exist, but there is also a lot more sort of axes.
There's space there.
Yeah, there's space there.
There's space to play.
But yeah, it is a horror story set in the Victorian era, and it does bang, but it very much has a modern sensibility. It's not like, you know, M.R. James... tackling casting the runes or A Warning to the Curious or whatever, where it's steeped in very English ancient worries, whereas this one, things are ancient but they're literally billions of years old, so it never feels connected to the ground in England.
That's a good way to put it, actually.
Thank you. I've been thinking about it a lot.
I mean, when you talk about it's going for that sort of Victorian horror, it reminded me a little bit of the kind of Barry Letts, Robert Banks Stewart kind of era of trying to emulate the sort of Gothic horror.
The Fourth Doctor's mid to late stuff, really.
Sort of Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane, for the most part.
Not early.
Whereas that, I think, was more or less dealing with themes of Gothic horror, but with a sort of sci-fi setting. This is like dealing with modern issues with a Victorian setting.
It's all a metaphor for modern conflict around the anxieties. Idea of progress, right?
And again, it's about how the Conservatives are terrible and Thatcher is awful.
It's about how being gay is extremely good and fuck the Tories.
Yes.
Which are values we as a podcast fully support.
Yes, absolutely. It's so interesting that Mark Platt went, you know, I can't write my story set on Gallifrey, so I'm going to set it in Victorian England, one of the most incorrectly viewed as repressive and completely shut down, like completely emotionally closed off era as people consider it. And he's like, this is the best allegory for Gallifrey that I have, is the Victorian era where no one fucks and is extremely colonialist, and everyone literally at 1.7 uses the words noble savage, and you're like, no!
No, can we put those words in the bin?
in the bit.
Yeah, I don't think they ever even used those words with Leela.
I feel like they might do. I remember that being.
I think it's done intentionally derogatory rather than non-critically. Mm. If that makes sense.
I don't think Seven is using it necessarily non-critically. He's using it sarcastically, I think, but it's still like, don't do that, Seven. Don't do that. I guess that's a good segue into talking about how this story sort of discusses colonialism, the othering of, you know, people who are considered, I don't know, non-human, and also the Empire, because it's all...
The Emperor in general.
It's all tangled up in this story in a way that is very difficult to tease apart, much like everything else.
I think had it been a four-episode one, it would have had more space to actually... play with that theme and
discuss it
rather than just have it.
I'd always heard it was supposed to be a four-parter and they made him cut an episode, but now I'm thinking maybe that was just a rumour and actually it was just supposed to be a fucked up hour-long nightmare experience. Which I kind of appreciate. But yeah, because there's all this stuff about Redvers wanting to hunt things and it turns out he's hunting himself and you're like, ooh, what's going on here? Mm. And then, you know... control is like this kind of she civilizes herself essentially, which is interesting to me in that it shows and that no exterior force is actually necessary.
I mean, the point of this episode is that the real monster was the Victorian gentleman all along.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas the Neanderthal was, you know, he's the character that the Doctor is instantly kind to and nice to and never treats with respect.
The audience instantly warms to as well.
He's the best.
Whereas, like, the Doctor is actively hostile towards Josiah.
And again, right to be so.
Absolutely. Yeah. Warms up to Redvers as soon as he finds out that Redvers is planning to assassinate Queen Victoria. Again, we get it. I did have one more note about the horror vibes, which is that on Letterboxd I saw someone compare it to Sapphire and Steel. I don't know if you've watched Sapphire and Steel, either of you.
No. I'm aware of it.
It is a 1980s, I believe, serial sort of horror sci-fi ghost series where David McCallum and Joanna Lumley play these extremely unexplained, like, mysterious, ambiguous figures who turn up. They're called Sapphire and Steel, and they turn up places where there are ghosts, and they fight the ghosts. And nothing is ever explained in any depth, and it's all really confusing and scary.
Wow.
It's great. I genuinely recommend it. I watched one with my mum and dad once and I was like, I don't get it. It's scary. I think that one was a haunted house, actually. It was good. They're all called like Case One or something. Like, none of them have like proper titles and it's good. And again, Big Finish has a series on it. I actually opened Big Finish so I could look at all of the franchises that they have series for now. There are so many. But yeah, it's I recommend Sapphire and Steel. That's my point. And yes, they did put most of Doctor Who back on Letterboxd, except the Gunfighters. Like, the Smugglers is on there, and they haven't put the Gunfighters back up. Literally homophobia to me personally.
Not massive discussion point, but I love how literal the episode title is.
Yeah.
Someone called Light and they're kind of a ghost. There you
go. Can we talk about how the German title is House of a Thousand Frights?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's beautiful.
It's good. Hausen der ein Tausend Schrecken or whatever it was. I don't speak German.
Mm-hmm. Really?
What, really, that I don't speak German? I know, I was so convincing in my pronunciation.
I also like your addition to, like, the last-minute reveal of the plot to assassinate Queen Victoria. Mate, a lot of people tried.
A lot of people tried to assassinate Queen Victoria. I'm pretty sure Horrible Histories did a sketch about it.
A lot of people also tried to assassinate Thatcher, so...
Yeah, God, I wish. There's a fucking Short Trip where the Doctor prevents a plot to assassinate Thatcher, and it's like, he wouldn't. He simply
wouldn't.
Why? He simply wouldn't.
No.
Let me get this straight. A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard, it can move anywhere in time and space?
Yes.
Quite so.
But that's ridiculous.
So, we have a couple of episode-related things. Ace would later tell the Doctor that her friend Manisha was killed when her flat was attacked by the firebomb attack, which scorched her flat. This is like one of those things that's variable depending on what expanded universe thing you read about it, whether she was killed or not. The Torchwood Institute would later investigate the Doctor's involvement in the Gabriel Chase incident, And the Time Worm would later reprimand the Doctor for his actions in Gabriel Chase. I still don't understand.
What is the Time Worm?
I don't know. Like, Time Worm is this series of the novels, but I don't know what's going on with it at all. Like, I don't know anything about it. It's so
strange. Like, if you know anything about Time Worm, do write in.
Please.
Or just tweet at Rosie.
Yeah, specifically at Rosie.
Not the pod, just at Rosie.
Yeah. And then the next subcategory is about Manisha. I'm probably going to pronounce her last name wrong, but I will do my best. So it's Manisha Pakayasta, was a friend of Ace. And because she was from Pakistan, her house was fired.
I think there is a Friend of Ace Twitter account.
Yes.
Which is...
We do love Friend anyway, of Ace. It's a good one. Her house was firebombed by neo-Nazis in 1983, wounding her or killing her, depending on what you look at. And enraged by this, Ace burned down Gabriel Chase. We know about that part of it. Accounts differed as to whether she nearly died, which happened in Time of Apocalypse, or actually did, which is from Blood Heat, The Dimension Riders, and Illegal Alien. In an alternate timeline, a version of Manisha existed who lived because her house had never been attacked. However, Ace had been killed, and that Manisha had watched her die. Jesus Christ.
I adore how fucked up the extended universe is.
Yeah, so that one is from Blood Heat, which is the 19th version New Adventures novel. It was written by Jim Mortimer and features the 7th Doctor, Ace, and Bernice Summerfield, and it's the first new adventure novel to delve into an alternate universe spawned from alternate events of Doctor Who and the Silurians. Every detail about this book is fucking insane.
Go on.
Okay, so I've opened it up. Right, okay, so... there's a couple of things that are just, like, you know, the references. So, like, for example... Ace finds a sonic screwdriver in the brackets dead close brackets third Doctor's pockets.
Okay.
The Doctor has two more ribs than a human. Joe Grant was sent to retrieve the launch codes the Brigadier planned to use. She goes insane from radiation exposure and race memory malaise. Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart injects a stimulant into Joe Grant to get information from her, and it kills her.
No, not Joe.
Liz Shaw married a man named James Lester who hit his head looking for food and died.
Okay. All right, then.
And then there's a lot of stuff about dinosaurs. Apparently they're like riding dinosaurs around, which is quite fun. Ace lifts the TARDIS belonging to the alternate Doctor, which had fallen on its doors, single-handedly and with a broken arm.
God, she's hot.
She is very hot. Ace makes the alternate universe TARDIS materialise around the entire planet Earth, placing everything in a state of temporal grace. Classic. The Doctor takes his third self's TARDIS from the alternate universe, as his is lost in a tar pit.
What?
It's insane.
You know, sometimes you just get your TARDIS stuck in a tar pit and you gotta steal your previous self's version of it.
Yeah, that did happen. It was a messy ride to work.
Apparently Jim Mortimer published a director's cut of this version of this novel in 2015, so he had to rename a whole bunch of people. But also he added a lot of details, changed things around. There's bits with the Master in it.
This sounds fucked up.
It does.
In a really entertaining way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got some illustrations.
Nice. We love a good illustration.
Yeah. You know, it just sounds completely demented and I want to read it. And then we have our short trip of the episode, very exciting, which is Mark Platt. Mark Platt, for the record, has written fucking loads of Doctor Who content, and all of the stuff by him that I've encountered, I've adored. Because he wrote the Battlefield novelization, which fucked. He wrote fucking Spare Parts. Like,
oh, nice. I still need to listen to Spare Parts.
Oh my god, Aim. You need to listen to Spare Parts so bad. But yeah, so the short trip is from Short Trips Monsters, which is the 9th Big Finish Short Trips anthology. And it is called Last Rites. It is very strange. It's like an eco-horror story about a world that was ravaged by strip mining being infested with rat kings. So rat kings, if anyone is not aware, is this sort of weird... I wouldn't know how to describe it, like a pseudo-animal? It's not quite a cryptid.
Not a real, yeah.
Yeah, it's a collection of rats whose tails are intertwined and bound together by one of several possible mechanisms. So, like, they do exist, but it's hard to tell how they occur, I guess. But in this case, the answer that Mark Platt comes up with is that rats are ever present throughout the universe, and the Rat King is a way of producing an enhanced like psychic link between them that makes them more powerful and more able to just chow down on lots of things.
Yeah.
So basically, the Ace and Seven are on this planet, and they are stubbornly refusing to evacuate it because they're trying to help out the native population of the planet who have been conned out of all of the natural resources of the planet by this guy who said 300 years ago that he was going to come back and help them out in 300 years. And the Doctor's like, that's probably not going to happen. But the thing is that he does come back. It's just that he is now a death-like figure made of rats. and he has come
Goals.
To... enact his promise by strip mining a different planet, bringing all of those resources through a time rift and plunging them back into the planet that he is currently on. Which doesn't seem to me like it's going to work very well.
Feels like an intergalactic pyramid scheme.
Yeah, it is basically. Like, he's in this ongoing chain and he can never rest until he finishes his last contract, but he will never be able to finish the last contract because... he keeps having to sign a new one to fulfill the previous one. It's very strange. I really liked it, but I could not tell you exactly what happened. Very ghost-like energy. it's like, I don't know, and the native life on the planet is like frog aliens, and there's like robots that are enforcing the rule of this mining company, and it's very Doctor Who-y, and I would love to see it adapted as an episode because I think it would be great. I got like two quotes. One of them is, Ace looked around the weather-beaten passenger lounge. That'd be worth seeing. Will there be an explosion? Probably the reverse. An implosion? Boring. You are a slave to the instant gratification of the loud bang, he snapped. The discerning find far more pathos and resonance in the whimper. Seven is great. And then we also have, as the SG turned to its colleagues, Ace nudged the Doctor. How's it complain? Chapter 3. It's in the TARDIS library. One of Tegan's, I expect, he said, dusting down his jacket and still looking puzzled. Ace and Tegan would get along so well.
They would. Besties.
Tegan and Nyssa taking Ace on holiday. That's what I want.
Yes! Oh my god.
Nyssa and Tegan adopting
Polycule.
Ace.
Polycule.
Yes!
The former companion Polycule must be insanely good. Like,
I don't know. I feel like...
Imagine how messy the drama is.
It would be
I want to see so Tegan good. And Nyssa as kind of... Ace's like gay mums, and
yeah,
they adopt
gay
her
arms who just
take her to Centre Parks and.
Okay, I like that. I like that sort of the same amount. So maybe I can have some AUs of itself. Somewhere she meets them when they're all teens, and somewhere she meets them when they're her mums. But yeah, it is a very good short story. I highly recommend it. I don't want to spoil too much about it, but basically, it's just fucking weird, and I love it. Thank you, Mark Platt, for my life.
Cool. That brings us on to ranking time. My X of the week is going to be aesthetic of the week, Ace in a Tux.
Yes.
You
that's it. That's all, baby. That's all I've got for you.
My X of the week is probably accidental reference of the week, which is the Doctor listing mythical creatures that the light has failed to catalogue reminded me very distinctly of Blackadder telling Samuel Johnson a bunch of made-up fake nonsense words in Blackadder III.
Yes.
May I offer you my most enthusiastic contrafibularities?
My burnt toast of the week goes to the... goes to Josiah for being the most burnt toast man since Burnt Master. his kind of husk forms.
Nice.
We have a 1 degree of Blake 7 this episode, which is that Carl Forgione, who played Nimrod, was in the Blake 7 episode Mission to Destiny as Gravain. Probably not with the Neanderthal makeup, I'm going to imagine.
Oh, I wish, though.
Yeah.
I thought I recognised his voice.
Yeah, this was Terry Nation's favourite episode of the first season. Avon would later quote Callie's Auron proverb that a man who trusts can never be betrayed, only mistaken in Blake 7 Rescue.
I
that
love
is an
that
extremely
quote.
Un-Avon thing to say, which I love the character development that is implied there.
Mm.
And then John Leeson, who plays Pasco in this story, later appeared as Toys in Blake 7 Gabbit. He is also known as the voice of K-9 in Doctor Who.
Is he?
The voice of who? I've never heard of this character.
Yeah, and then this is the first episode in which the Federation plays no part in the action at all, merely being mentioned in a conversation between Blake and Kendall. Destiny is the first human colony scene which is not a Federation member, which is great, because the Federation in Blake 7 is, like, overtly evil.
Are you planning a Blake 7 spin-off podcast?
Yeah, I still cannot believe that in the first episode of Blake 7, very, very well-beloved children's entertainment program for the 1970s and 80s, Blake is falsely accused of molesting a child. And in order to get him on those charges, they implant false memories in the said child.
Oh boy.
Jesus.
Normal TV. We live in a very normal country.
Very normal.
Great. What are we going to give this out of 5?
Great question.
I give it a 3. I think there's a lot to like in this. I think it falls short in that it is the storytelling is a bit messy and it could be smoother. But like, I like a lot of what it's trying to do, and I like a lot of the visuals, and I like a lot of the characterization. But I feel like the plot needed to be tightened up and tidied up a bit more, which, as I recall, the novelization does tidy up quite substantially. But that we're not talking about the novelization; we're talking about the TV version.
I'd probably go for a 3.5 stone spaceships out of 5. It takes so many of my boxes, but it's not a perfect episode by many.
You are both demented. I'm giving it 4.5 husks out of 5. It is incredible.
Cool.
I love this so much. It is so good.
I loved it, but I know how much I loved it for the idiosyncrasies, which is probably quite.
But you're
just
allowed
me.
To give it lots of stars for having idiosyncrasies, babe.
I enjoyed it, but it didn't resonate as a lot as some of the other stories I've given that higher rating.
That's
to.
That's fair.
A lot of the stuff that I like in this story has been done in other stories, like in this series, and done better in those series. Like all the stuff between Ace and Seven, I think, is done better in Curse of Fenric. All the sort of aesthetic stuff is done better in like Survival and Curse of Fenric, and like a lot of the stuff that I like is done better elsewhere in the same series. But yeah, that's my feelings on it.
Yeah, I think it's, even though I enjoyed a lot of it, it wouldn't be top tier Doctor Who for me. So
tragic. I really enjoyed it, but
I
that's
know.
Life. Right.
I really enjoyed it.
Now here's the thing. I will also say I gave it 4.5. That doesn't mean that I liked it as much as some of the stories I've given 3.5. Like,
I'm feeling very democratic today, so I must be fair to everything I've ever seen.
Yes. Right. So where are we putting it on our overall ranking?
I would put it below tracking.
Oh, quite low. I would put it
quite low out of 35. It's above middle.
I would put it. I would put it under the Gunfighters, because I love the Gunfighters beyond measure and reason.
I'd be happy with that compromise. Yeah, that's fine with me.
Joel, do you have any contribution to this?
I do think Stones of Blood was better.
I think Stones of Blood.
Stones of Blood is objectively better, but
Stones of Blood is great.
But does it have Ace in it? Does it have Ace in it? Is the real question.
Okay, I know you win. You win.
This is true. Yeah.
And where did those pesky kids down at the Doctor Who magazine put it?
That's a great question. Would you like to guess? And then we'll find out together.
I'm going to guess around 62.
Okay. Joel, where do you think it went on the Mighty 200 ranking?
It's going to be somewhere in the high hundreds, I think, because I know that those people hate the Seventh Doctor. So I'm going to guess like 150.
They're wrong.
I'm going to go 115. Let's find out. 76.
Oof.
I win.
It is below the Time Meddler and above the Visitation.
Yes, I feel like it's got enough going for it to be remembered fondly.
I watched the Time Meddler recently. That story is incredible and I love it.
Yeah,
okay. I watched it with
the Awakening
Ben actually.
Is brilliant.
A lot of Doctor Who is very good. Let's accept this. There's a reason we're doing a podcast about
it's a good
it.
Show. It is a good show. Even when it's a bad show, it's a good
That's
show.
That's so true, actually. That's so true. But yeah, so right. I guess...
Do you want to sing us out?
I guess that's the end of our episode. Joel has written 3 books and you should read them. He is also the host
yes,
of the Campaign Trail podcast, which is about fantasy politics and is quite good and also has AIM on it. And S. Naomi Scott and Stephen J. Poor. So there's lots of people on it that have been on this podcast.
And Joe Hall, who is yet to guest on the podcast, but will one day.
Yes. Thank you very much for listening to Reversing Polarity, a Doctor Who fancast. This episode, we celebrated Ghostlight, which, as it turned out, some people didn't like as much as it seemed they liked.
I liked it. I'm just feeling weird about ratings today.
Anyway, thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you for listening to us discuss Ghostlight. Thank you for listening to us scream about how good Dorothy Ace McShane is. She is ultimate wife. And
perfect.
We look forward to you joining us in 2 weeks for our next episode, a very special semi-musical episode on The Gunfighters. Yes! Yeah. With rings on their fingers and bells on their toes, the girls come
to I'm going to stop my recording.